Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and welcome to the show. My heart is soaring now. I have four people on the line here ready to chat with me. Looking forward to that. We've had a couple of lean weeks, or maybe a month, where we just haven't had that many callers. I love it when you call in, and I think that some people don't call in because they don't think they can get in, but that's not the case. Today, we have pretty much a full board for this hour, and I'll get to you very shortly, but most of the time, we don't. So please take an opportunity if you want to chat with me about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I'll do my best to respond well to your comments or your questions, and that's how it works. But you have to call in, or else you just can listen to me doing monologues. Speaking of which, I have a couple of words to say before I get to my fine callers here. And it's kind of following on the heels of the commentary from the last show. And so it has to do with claims about the Bible and homosexuality. Now, I'm revisiting something I talked about, but just from a little different angle. And I'm not going to beat this dead horse, so to speak. I'm not going to keep banging away at this. But I do, I just want to, I want to say one more thing. So I have a little meme here, and I think we actually responded to this, Tim Barnett did, in a Red Pen Logic. Incidentally, if you're not familiar with it, just go to, the simplest way, I guess, is go to YouTube, type in Red Pen Logic, and you'll see a bunch of stuff that we've done, that Tim has done. Fabulous. Okay. And I won't go into detail on it, but they're great. They're not long either. Anyway, this is from John Pavlovitz, who is as far as I could tell, a progressive Christian. I could be wrong, but I'm just giving credit where credit's due here. And so he's got a little dialogue here, and I'll just read it to you very quickly. It's a meme. Me, Jesus never says being LGBTQ is a sin. Them, but Leviticus, me, but not Jesus. Them, but Romans, me, not Jesus. Them, 1 Timothy, me, sigh. Jesus is never going to hate people the way you want him to hate people. That's going to be a you problem. All right, so there it is. Now, this is an old canard, and it's a tiresome canard because we've addressed it many times. I even said something about it last show. Okay, just because Jesus never seemed to condemn a particular thing doesn't mean he's just fine with it. That's a non sequitur. And we can think of all kinds of things Jesus never condemned, at least in the record, the very limited record we have. But that doesn't mean he's in favor of it. Why? Because we know these things are wrong. So my simple point here is, even if it's true that Jesus never condemned homosexuality. By the way, keep in mind his audience. It is principally Jews, though he did speak quite a bit. He went to Gentile regions, the Decapolis, the Ten Cities region, east of the Sea of Galilee, like what we would call the Golan now, north, the Tyre and Sidon. These are all Gentile regions. When he cast the demons into the pigs, that wasn't Jews, those were Gentiles, obviously. They had pigs. And so, but for the most part, Jesus is speaking into a culture that already has revelation on this, and that is the Torah. And just keep in mind, Jesus was a Torah observant Jew. And this is all you need to know in answering this question. There's more. I responded to it a little bit last show. But it does not matter if Jesus never said anything about LGBTQ. All right. And the reason is because Jesus was a Torah observant Jew. He quoted Moses frequently as speaking for God. He says in the Sermon on the Mount, not one letter or stroke of the law shall be removed. If you say that this doesn't count, forget about it. You're the least in the kingdom. And then he puts the law heavy on the shoulders of people to show that justification cannot come through law. That's all Matthew 5. Your righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. So, John Pavlovitz, do you think that this has anything to do with sexual behavior? Do you think that Jesus would affirm any type of sex outside of marriage when every type of sex outside of marriage was condemned by Moses? Really? With what justification would you say that? This is why, friends, I call this a tiresome canard, because it's nonsense. It takes us nowhere. It seems compelling, but it's vacuous. It's empty. It's just air. It's just propaganda. And I'm trying to do this not condescendingly, but descriptively. Don't be taken in by this. It does not matter what Jesus said publicly or what was recorded about what he said about what we now call LGBTQ. And by the way, that's a human invention. Why don't I just dismiss that? Because I know what he's getting at. But it doesn't matter if Jesus never condemns that, because he was a Torah observant Jew, which means he's in favor of everything, and he says this in multiple ways that Moses wrote that is morally obligatory upon those to whom it applies. And that would be the whole law to Jews to whom he was speaking, including those sexual parts. So why would Jesus say, oh, by the way, if you're gay, that's fine. I'll walk with you in the parade where you're promoting your gayness. Really? I mean, it's so absurd that it part of me thinks, why do I even need to say this to anybody? But apparently it's necessary. And also, by the way, just for the record, Jesus did have a clear view about marriage. Matthew 19, to sum it up for you, one man with one woman becoming one flesh, which is sex, for one lifetime. One man, one woman. Notice the binary sexual perspective that Jesus had. So he's not going to be all in favor of LG, lesbian, gay, bi, T, trans. All right, that's the T, trans. No, I don't think so. He did say something against trans when he said one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. That's his understanding of marriage. And it goes right back to the very beginning, Moses, Genesis chapter 2, and pretty straightforward. And notice, by the way, that that formula, which is my summation of Jesus' comments in Matthew 12, or 19 rather, that formula excludes everything sexually that is prohibited in the Old Testament. Adultery, fornication, bestiality, and homosexuality. Because they're all sex with someone who is not your heterosexual lifetime married partner. This is not hard, friends. This is not tricky. So please don't be taken in by the size of John Pavlovitz, who now is characterizing your biblical view, and I guarantee you the view of Jesus, as hating people. See, that's another little rhetorical arm-twisting, ledger domain, sleight of hand that's going on. Oh, you think that homosexuality is wrong? You must be filled with hate. Well, I guess Jesus was filled with hate since he was a Torah observant Jew. And, Mr. Pavlovitz, if you have a high Christology, which I suspect you don't, I don't condemn you for it, I'm just observing. High Christology mean you think that Jesus is not just a man, but he's also God, which is what the text teaches. Okay, in many different ways. If he is God, and God inspired the Bible, which Jesus believed, then Jesus, or I should say the pre-incarnate Word of God, is responsible for the whole Word of God. That means all of that stuff that is written there that condemns all kinds of things are things that Jesus not just agrees with as a human being, but is responsible for as a divine being. All right? Okay, with that in mind, wow, that was fast. It wasn't a half hour, 9 minutes. Let's go to our callers and okay, I'm pausing here because, Ted, is there really a town called Peculiar, Missouri?
Yes, indeed.
No kidding. There's one thing I can say about that name with complete safety. It is really peculiar. Right?
True.
I'm safe.
That's the only reason we live here.
Yeah, okay. Where is that? Approximately.
It's just south of Kansas City. South of Kansas City, about a half hour.
Oh, okay. So it's way west. It's west
you,
in the
yeah,
state.
Or...
No, it's west. I'm given the state, it's in the western part of the state because Kansas City is on the western border, right? With Kansas.
Yeah, we're only a few miles from the state line.
Oh, okay.
Into Kansas.
Okay, now I know. So I actually went to basic training at Fort Leonard, well, what we used to call Fort Leonard and Lost in the Woods, but you know where that is, probably, right in the middle
of
the state.
Yeah, I went to Rolla. So we trounced around those woods, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, Mr. Ted from Peculiar, Missouri, what's on your mind?
Well, just a timely topic, I think, about Halloween.
Oh, yeah, coming up a few days.
Yeah, more specifically, my wife forwarded me a Facebook podcast from a gal who apparently used to practice witchcraft, and now she's a Christ follower.
Uh-huh.
So a big part of her ministry apparently is to, you know, educate people about some of the demonic roots of things, like, as she described in what I heard, Halloween. And so she she described things like how dressing up in costumes was a way to hide yourself from the demons, and decorating a jack-o'-lantern as a way to scare away the demons, mm-hmm. and saying trick-or-treat has its roots and so forth. So she lays out this lot of historical context, apparently, that I can't validate or refute, but I'll take her at her word.
Okay.
And her argument is basically, because this is with the roots, when you partake in these similar activities, you're also opening yourself up to demonic activity. Hmm. And I want to save you from that, so I want to educate you. So that was kind of her premise. And I have some initial thoughts, but I thought, I searched your website for Halloween, didn't find anything, so I figured I'd give you a call.
Okay.
Get your take on it.
Yeah, sure. I do have a few things to say about this, and I'll just say as a broad response, I disagree with the person who did the thing in virtually every single thing that she claims. All right. And therefore, the consequence or the recommendation I would give as a result is going to be different as well. Okay. I do not think, look at when Paul, there's a couple ways I could approach this, but I'll just grab some things. When Paul talked about idols, he said, there is nothing in an idol. An idol is nothing. You know, the prophet said, they have eyes they can't see, they have mouths they can't speak, they have ears they can't hear, and who makes them are like them, kind of thing. They're just wood, okay? They don't have this internal power, all right, to them. And this is why meat sacrificed to idols, and think of that. Well, this didn't have any inherent evilness to it, even though some people thought so, and they were skeptical. And so Paul said, well, don't bother those folks. But, you know, meat offered to an idol's nothing. And so the meat is not somehow tainted because it was offered there. You can eat it. And apparently if you got meat offered to idols, it was cheaper than regular. So, you know, poor people could eat that. But notice that what Paul seems to be saying is there's nothing in the thing itself, even though the thing can be used by others for something that's wrong. It is the thing that they use it for that is spiritually suspect, not the thing they are using. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so I think there's a number of places like that, and I cited some here. I can't give you the chapter and verse, but you could look it up. You just see this point, okay?
Yeah.
Secondly, is that just because, okay, so the mention there, you wear costumes. Costumes was to scare away the demons, okay? Is this person then against all costume parties of any kind under any circumstance? What do you think?
Yeah, I had a similar thought. Yep.
Yeah, I doubt it. Well, why not about all costumes, but simply about costumes on this night? Oh, the difference, I suspect, is that in these others' costumes, people who are wearing them were not trying to scare demons away. I mean, just think of, Shakespeare. So you got stage plays, people wear costumes. They didn't even have women actors. They had women, they had men pretending they were women. And sometimes they had masks that they would use in, you know, old stage productions. That's where this, concept of hypocrite came from. You're hiding behind a mask. You've got a mask that shows one thing, but the real self is underneath and behind it. So these are all costumes. Oh, that's not a problem. Why not? Well, because they are not being used for occultic purposes. Okay. When you wear a costume on Halloween, are you using that for occultic purposes?
Yeah, that's the core question. That's what matters, right?
What's the answer?
No, for us, of course.
No, for anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, almost anybody. And when you think of all the kids and people who dress up in costumes, that people are not using these for occultic purposes. Now, it may not be wise to you wear costumes with occultic themes, but in my view, for a different reason. If I dressed up as a devil and I had a red suit and a pitchfork and all that other stuff and I'm dancing around, I'm not going to attract demons to myself. I have no reason to believe that demons are going to be attracted to my outfit. Right?
Yeah.
How has that opened me for demonic activity? Now, she might say, well, I know it does because this is what happened in my experience in the occult. Well, okay, there's a testimony about that. That makes no sense to me. And greater is he who is in me than who he is in the world. And Paul seems to indicate that these things don't matter. And maybe when you were in the cult, you were vulnerable because you were in the cult. Mm-hmm. But now that you're a Christian, I don't see why that vulnerability continues in the way that it did for you before. So I'm not, even if I were wearing a Satan outfit. Now, I don't think we should do that, but for an entirely different reason. What happens when you dress up like Satan in a red tights and you have a pitchfork and some horns and you're dancing around on Halloween? People do not take Satan seriously. It's treating a very significant spiritual thing in a frivolous way. And I do think that there is some traction that the enemy gets in terms of a spiritual scheme with regards to Halloween. And that is, when it comes to occultic things, they make it look frivolous and a game when it's not. And this is probably something that the person that you're referring to and I would completely agree on. But notice it's not because there are occultic powers attached to the objects. It's because what I'm acting out in that instance is a pattern or a way of minimizing or frivolous. I don't think frivolizing is a word. So taking spiritual things, demonic things, in a frivolous way, and that is a problem. Okay, but that would be true not just of Halloween costumes. That would be true of a whole bunch of other things that might be trivializing genuine spiritual dangers. All right?
So, that's really good. I had not thought of that, and I don't believe she brought that up in her monologue. So
no, it's interesting.
That's a great point.
That to me is a much bigger danger. I don't think that, you know, jack-o'-lanterns, maybe jack-o'-lanterns were made in the past to scare demons away. That isn't, you know, we put a jack-o'-lantern out. I mean, if we were, it would be just to light the way and display that here, you can come to our house and trick or treat. All right. That's all. It's not because we're trying to scare any demons away. We actually have a pumpkin outside of our house, but it's not got a face on it with a candle in it. So what is cutting a face on it? How does that invest it with some kind of spiritual magnetism that draws demons to us? I am not practicing an occultic thing. It is not what I'm doing. I'm just carving a pumpkin. You know, what if I put a Jesus' name in the pumpkin? Would that scare the demons away because it says Jesus? I don't think any way the pumpkin is configured has anything to do with demons. I have no reason to believe that. And so, does that make sense?
Oh, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's right.
Yeah, what I think she would say, and she did say many times in her podcast, she would kind of play devil's advocate. That's no pun intended.
That's interesting.
Well, you think it's innocent. You know, you're dressing up in a costume. You think that's innocent. But you can't, and this is what she kept repeating, but you can't separate that activity from the origin.
Yes, you can.
She kept repeating that.
You absolutely can.
Yeah.
You absolutely can. That is an assertion that she is making. And why isn't the same thing with meat sacrificed to idols then? How can you separate that meat from the idolatrous practices that it was a part of? I mean, what is that a perfect parallel or what? I don't know what's a better parallel right out of the text. And Paul said, no, it's nothing. There's nothing here to worry about. Okay. So I don't agree with her point. When she keeps saying you can't separate it, of course you can separate it because one is not related to another. That she says you can't separate it just because she was a witch doesn't mean that she's an authority on the spiritual substance of that with regards to me as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm not dismissive of her experience and things she has to say, but it doesn't mean I have to take everything that she says as gospel, so to speak, right? So if that's her defense, that's not a defense. All that is as an assertion. How does she justify the idea that when you mimic some behavior that someone else used for occultic purposes, that you somehow are getting involved in those spiritual events themselves? Okay, how does she justify? Okay, now I'm going to flip and go to another direction because I'm going to make this same point from another side. All right, you're familiar with Catholicism, I imagine, a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that they have a rosary they pray.
Yeah.
Okay, so rosary is an artifact that is used to direct particular prayers to Mary. All right, I'm not criticizing or anything. I'm just making an observation. Okay, if a non-Christian holds the rosary and says the words, are they praying to Mary?
I would say no.
I agree with you, because they have no intention of communicating to Mary. They're just making noise, holding an artifact. Yeah. There is no spiritual power invested in that artifact. But according to your friend in the piece that she did, podcast or whatever it is, you cannot separate the object from its origin. It continues to have the same spiritual significance. Think of all of these people that wear crosses, all these rappers with big crosses around their neck and all that other stuff. So a cross has spiritual significance, right? Jesus died on a cross. So are they somehow participating in a spiritual enterprise by wearing crosses when they're rapping or singing or whatever they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
No, of course not.
Yeah. No, good point. Yeah.
It's just an object. Okay, now here's the kicker. Halloween started out as a Christian holiday, not as an occultic holiday. It takes its name from All Hallows Eve. And in fact, Halloween or Hallows Eve is on the calendar. It's practiced by liturgical churches, including certainly the Roman Catholic Church. What ended up happening, and this is just the history of it, it starts out one way and it gets corrupted. It got corrupted because of the Catholic practices that invade that holiday with darker significance, calling on dead people, all the saints or whatever, and then it gets more and more distorted. So there is a history here, but the history is taking something that started out as an honoring of the saints, and then it gets twisted into something darker. All right? And there's the interesting book. I mean, I'm trying to... Amy, do you have that information? Did you already put it out there? Yeah. No, she's going to type it up here for me. The Halloween book and gal that I talked about. Remember we were just talking in the break about the gal that we know from Talbot, Biola, who wrote the book about Halloween? I can't remember her name, though. Amy's getting it. Angie Mosteller. Okay, A-N-G-I-E, first name. Last name, M-O-S-T-E-L-L-E-R. Angie Mosteller. And she has written, actually, a number of books, but one of them is on Halloween. And she gives all the background and all the history. And she demonstrates that what Halloween is a religious holiday, a spiritual holiday that's perverted for darkness' sake. And all these things are added. It didn't start out as a dark thing. The irony of this fact, Ted, is that if that's true, and she chronicles it all, if it's true, that means all of these Satanists or all these occult people are actually practicing Christianity. Because you can't separate from the origins, right?
That's
the
good
claim. But you can, of course. Yeah. You can separate it. And I gave you counterexamples with crosses and rosaries and even All Hallows Eve, Halloween itself. You can separate it. Obviously, you can.
Yeah, that's great insight, man. Thank you so much, Greg.
Okay, buddy. I'll let you get back to Peculiar, Missouri and do whatever you want to do about Halloween. Maybe one last thing I'll say about that, Ted, is what I've offered are what I think are factual assessments of the history and the practices and some of the things about demonic activity, et cetera, scriptural references. So that sets the playing field. Now, if somebody doesn't like Halloween because it just feels creepy, my wife is an example of that. She doesn't like jack-o'-lanterns because of the reasons that the woman described. No, I don't think that's theologically sound, but I respect my wife's sensitivities. So no jack-o'-lanterns for us. Not a problem. So I think that we should respect people who have personal qualms about these things and let them exercise their Christian liberty in their own way. But to claim that some were exercising an appropriate liberty by dressing up in costumes and having jack-o'-lanterns are somehow participating in the occult, this is just flat-out false.
Yeah, it's kind of parallel to, correct me if I'm wrong, but something along the lines of, if it causes your brother to stumble, don't do it.
Well, the last point, maybe, because I think people misunderstand the stumbling part. Stumbling doesn't mean you disagree with it. Stumbling means you cause your brother to fall into sin, and that's a little different situation. But I am making the point about Christian liberty, and that is the broader point that Paul is making in those exhortations about stumbling, because he tells us not to cause our brother to stumble, but he also tells the weaker brother not to judge the stronger brother, and so it goes two ways there.
Okay.
All righty. I better run. I'm not even going to take a break, but I'm going to talk to my other friends here. They're online waiting. Okay, Ted?
Great. It's been an honor, Greg. Thank you.
Okay, and happy All Hallows Eve to you. Also known as Reformation Day, also known as the birthday of Melinda Penner. Okay.
All right.
All right. Take care, buddy. Let's go to Mr. Jeff in St. Bonnie, Minnesota.
And, hi, Greg. How are you?
Jeff, fine, and St. Bonnie is nicer than Peculiar. Just sounds
better.
Yeah,
you know, but it's not as cool as Peculiar in the name category. It's actually St. Bonifacius, but every time I tell people that, they butcher it. So
okay.
I just like to call it St. Bonnie.
St. Bonnie. All right, that's great. Where in Minnesota is that, roughly?
We are just beyond the western fringe of Lake Minnetonka.
So that's the larger Minneapolis area.
Yeah, but there's some farm, rural area just a little bit between us.
I gotcha. You know, I'm gonna be in Edna on Friday morning, November 12th, with Search Ministries at a breakfast there. I'm just saying, you know, if you're interested.
So I'm sorry. What town?
It's the town of Edna, EDNA, but that's in the metropolitan area of Minneapolis.
Oh, it's Edina.
So anyway, November 12th, and if you go to str.org/events, then the details are there. Anyway, so what's on your mind, Jeff?
Yeah. Couple weeks ago, my wife and I were in a Bible study, a couple's Bible study, and we're going through Deuteronomy.
Okay.
And we come across chapter 4, and then the middle chunk of chapter 4 is Moses giving a refresher warning to the people of Israel about idolatry.
Right.
By the way, a nice little segue from your previous call. And he's like, just a reminder, everyone, do not make yourself an idol out of shape of a man or woman or animal, bird, anything in the water. Don't bow down to the sun, moon, stars. The study book we're going through, and it seems like at least two or three sermons that I hear every year, always ask the question, what are you making an idol of in your life? And I always wonder when I read these passages, like, for example, our pastor went through Elijah on Mount Carmel, you know, facing off against the 400 prophets of Baal. It seems like all the examples they ever give in these studies, it actually is us, the God, idol worship. Then some friends will say, well, what about, I'm making something up, like college football? Is college football an idol in your life, Jeff?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, let's say I was obsessed with college football, and I spend every day on it, I spend hours on it, it's like a huge thing in my life. And I hate to sound lawyery about this, but wouldn't that fall into some other sin category? I would never tell someone that I'm worshiping college football.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I start to wonder.
Although.
And the problem is I've listened to you far too often, so I wonder you. It starts to make me wonder, is this what I consider a pastorism?
Yes. Uh-huh. That's fair. I tend to be suspicious of those kinds of sermons as well, at least characterized the way they are as applications of this prohibition in places like Deuteronomy. What's an idol in your life? And my sense is that even though I think that someone could have football as an idol, all right? Relationships could be an idol. That is, these are the pinnacle of their life. The summum bonum, the greatest good, is pursuit of this thing. And then that thing is replacing God. Now, classically, idols were objects. And this is what was prohibited in Deuteronomy. Don't make these objects because you're going to make these objects into something that they aren't. They're just pieces of wood or gold or silver or whatever, and you're making them into something divine, or at least using them as a vehicle of the divine. And so I think that those who made an idol of the Ashtoreth, I'm not exactly sure of this, but they believe that the thing that they're representing in the idol is not physical. It's non-physical, but there is a deep communion, unity, or something with that physical thing and the thing. So they could worship the physical thing and then therefore be worshiping what is behind the physical thing, the Ashtoreth, for example. And so that's what's being prohibited here. And I certainly think things like that can happen. I see people with all kinds of religious idols that are used as fetishes. In other words, they put things in their car because they think that this physical thing in their car is going to protect them. Well, that's idolatry, because they are treating it like a supernatural thing that will be their protector, all right? So I think that closely parallels what we see in Deuteronomy, and maybe more than parallel, it's the same thing. But when it comes to what is the idol in your life, I think this borders on taking a text and making a metaphor out of it. And so this, I think, is not sound. Now, it may be appropriate to ask, are you spending too much on this or that? Or are you spending too much time in this endeavor or that endeavor and not enough time doing other things that are more important and more valuable? But to call it an idol, I think, may be a stretch. But it's very common. I just let most of that roll off my back, to be honest with you. There may be an inappropriate. Look, a person could be inappropriately taken with human sexuality. This is true with a lot of people not Christian, and in fact, in this culture. And there's a whole movement to make sex everything, and it started, 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. And there's just this flow and I think it can get to a point where sex is one's God. But I don't think that's true for most people who are living sexually immoral lives. So I could say your sexual immorality is wrong, but it's not wrong because sex is an idol to you. It's wrong because it's sexual immorality. And I wish that in most cases when this idol imagery is offered, that it's not idolatry at all. I wish they would just cast their point in a different way than saying this is an idol in your life. I absolutely believe that there are things in some people's lives that have gained such ascendancy and centrality and importance in their life that it functions as a god for them. And probably with some people, football's like that. All right. And sex could be like that. And even a relationship with one's own spouse can be like that. Okay. But I don't think characteristically that's the case. I think characteristically it's lots of different kinds of sin, but it's not idolatry. Now, greed, Paul does identify as tantamount to idolatry. Okay. And at least greed. There's actually a list of things. The last one's greed. And he says, which amounts to idolatry. And so there, at least minimally, money in that list, greed, could be the god of someone's life. So it certainly is possible that things other than a physical idol can function as an idol in somebody's life. I just think that that point is overplayed by many pastors.
Okay. I think you're pretty much echoing what I think my take on this. I think I got hung up on the concept of if it really is an idol, it's kind of like, what is your intent when you're worshiping this thing? Do you think that idol is actually going to do something? Like those prophets of Baal, for example, that were dancing around that thing and
They expected something to happen.
They expected something to happen. So they really were worshiping it. The guy who's got football as the number one thing in his life doesn't expect college football to suddenly do something for him. It's just that it's the focus of his life.
Yeah, it's not going to rain down fire at an altar like there in 1 Kings, 18 or something, but there may be a different manifestation of the significance of that idol in his life. So I think it's probably safer just to think that there's a lot of things that can have an inappropriate hold on us, all right?
Yeah.
And you don't have to call it idolatry, the idol in your life, in order for it to be inappropriate, immoral, have a hold on you that is deleterious or something like that. So maybe this is just a preference thing, but I think a lot of times that whole point has been stretched a bit more than probably the passages here in Deuteronomy justify. Anyway, you know what? I do have to run. I got a bunch of more callers.
Yep.
Okay, Jeff, good talking to you. And
thanks a bunch.
Okay, thank you. In St. Bonnie, Minnesota. Let's just see here. Oh, that's a drop there. And let's see who's next. Okay, we're going to go to Austin in Fullerton. Hold on. There you are, Austin. Fullerton, California. Good Southern California
Greg.
Name, city name. Hey.
Yeah, totally. Born and raised in Orange County. Hey, longtime listener, first-time caller. So thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad you did.
My question is something I personally have never heard asked before, and I don't really hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
I growing up here in Southern California, my best friends are all Mexican and, you know, great people.
Right.
You know, we love them. And this goes into the next part I'm going to say. We have nothing against them, per se, but their parents are illegal immigrants, you know, so it's very common here, is my point. Mm-hmm. Very common. A lot of illegal immigrants in my church too.
Hmm.
And, you know, we love them and, you know, we don't really say anything about it. And so that's kind of my question. What should a pastor be saying to his congregation, when there are a lot of illegal immigrants there? And my grandfather, who's from Argentina, he got into it with his pastor a few years ago because he goes to a Spanish speaking church. And this is the first time I kind of thought about it, because his pastor was telling them, no, you don't need to go back to Mexico. You can stay here. There's no problem. And he talked with them and said, you can't be telling people this, you know, that they should just stay here. And so, I don't know. I hope you're kind of understanding my question.
Like, I do.
Because it's kind of the elephant in the room.
Yeah. Well,
I
understand perfectly, and I have never been asked this question before, and I actually have never thought about it. Although I think this question doesn't require a lot of thought. But before I give you my point of view, this pastor, either your church or whoever church, who is kind of has a cavalier attitude about the illegal immigrants in his community, does he require masks in the church, or did he when this was required by the state?
That's a question about my pastor?
Pardon me? Yeah, it's about whoever, whatever pastors having this dismissive idea about illegal immigrants in their church. Do those pastors require compliance with the government at whatever level with regards to COVID restrictions?
You know, my pastor is very well known. He never shut down, or he did shut down for a little bit, but he doesn't require masks.
Okay, so maybe it's not the best illustration, but here's what I'm getting at. Okay, let's just say they did. Okay, and if he doesn't, that's all right. But the point I'm making is that sometimes there are pastors that are going to be really sticklers on things, especially the last year and a half, regarding obeying the government, doing these things, putting the masks on, and all this other stuff, because that's what the government says, Romans 13. Now, if this is what they're saying regarding masks, but they have illegal immigrants in their community and they're fine with that, do you see an inconsistency?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I thought about
this. Yeah. Now, even if they don't require masks, all right, I was just trying to make a counterexample, so to speak. But regardless whether or not they require it, as one person was asked famously, before the phrase illegal immigrants became unacceptable phrase, all right, they were asked, what do you think about illegal immigrants? And he said simply, it's illegal, isn't it? It's illegal.
Yeah.
When if we have a border with guards that are meant to, at least in principle, keep people from coming into our property, and it doesn't matter what anybody thinks about the policies. I mean, I'm not addressing the broader question about immigration. I'm just saying this is something that, at least with regards to the books, historically we've taken seriously. You know, that we have, I go back and forth on occasion from San Diego, from where I live in Ventura County, down the 405 to the 5 down to San Diego. There's a check station there. When you're coming back from San Diego, you got to get checked. Why are they checking things? They're checking to see if there's illegal immigrants. This is a very significant legal issue, even if it's different administrations treat it in a cavalier manner. It still is a big deal. So if this is a big deal in the government and there are big laws that have to do with this, and we have fences and agencies and agents all trying to enforce this thing, how do we Christians who are supposed to respect the law and the rule of law say it's no big deal? Do you see the point?
Oh, yeah.
So I this is politically freighted. All right. But I do not understand why the pastor would not be fully justified in saying, if you are Christian and you are here illegally, go home. Honor God by obeying the government in this big issue. Go home.
And that's kind of my question. Yeah, I've never heard a pastor say that, ever.
I haven't either.
Saying that. I'm just wondering. So I wanted to hear your perspective on
that. Well, what if a person was, I can't say fornicating now, because that doesn't matter to a lot of pastors. Homosexuality matters to a lot of pastors. Maybe adultery matters. If you had somebody, you had a lot of adulterers in your congregation, what would you say? If you had people who were, look at swindlers. You know, it says this where is it? 1 Corinthians 5, when Paul is talking about disciplining that sexually aberrant individual there in the church that nobody's dealing with, he said, I told you not to, I'm looking it up right now, but not to, I didn't tell you not to associate with sinners in the world. You have to go out of the sinners, out of the world. He said, I told you not to associate with any so-called Christian. Let me find it here. Okay, verse 11. I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person, which is what he's talking about here, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or a swindler. Not even to eat with such a one. Verse 11, chapter 5, 1 Corinthians. What's a swindler? Somebody who takes something that's not theirs. Cleverly, in a clever way. It's not just thievery, it's swindling. It's a type of theft, but it's a cleverer type of theft. Okay. Now, I have never thought about this before this moment, I promise you, Austin, but wouldn't illegal aliens be qualified as swindlers? They're taking something in a clever way that's not theirs. And if not, why not? I'm not trying to be condescending or condemning or anything like that, finding fault. I'm just saying, you ask the question, I'm thinking, well, why wouldn't that be considered swindling according to the law of the land? And Paul says not even to eat with such a one. So if that's the way Paul views immorality in the body of Christ, what's the rectification for these problems? Repentance. And what's the repentance for the swindler of illegal alien, an illegal alien? And that is to not be illegal anymore. And how do you not be illegal? Well, you don't be an alien. It means you go home and you start over the legal way. Because I don't think you can, maybe you can find legal ways here. But see, a lot of people are just waiting. They're illegal. They're hoping that they'll be made legal by a fiat from on high, like the federal government. Okay, you're okay. We'll do that. And it's happened before. But notice the means. We're gonna become legal by being illegal. Well, that's not an appropriate means. So I've never thought about this before, but it seems to me this is entirely a legitimate way of looking at it. And pastors should weigh in with their congregations, not as an act of racism or hatred or bigotry, but as an act of appeal to obedience by their own Christian people.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, it's tough medicine for some people, but that's my answer, Austin. All right, brother. All right. Okay, thank you so much for the call. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were gone. Yeah. Okay, let's go to Washington and Josh. In Washington, welcome to the show, Josh.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there. What's up?
So my question is about Romans 14, 23.
All right, I'll go there.
It has to do with, I guess my question is, can we derive a principle from that passage by which anytime we feel that some action or not action is wrong, even if we didn't get that from the Bible per se, if we act against our conscience in any situation, basically, is that a sin based on that verse?
Yeah, the passage here, and I should read a couple verses above it. This has to do with about, you know, giving offense, eating and drinking and stuff. Verse 21, it's good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything by which your brother stumbles. Verse 22, the faith which you have as your own conviction before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. But verse 23, and this is your verse, he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he's eating is not from faith, and whatever is not from faith is sin. So what Paul is saying there is that the sin is not in the eating or drinking, but the sin is in violating your conscience, even if your conscience is not, in a certain sense, properly informed about the issue.
Right. Yeah.
And so if a person has a conscientious objection about something, and then still does the thing his conscience says is wrong, he's doing a wrong, even if it turns out that it's not really wrong, because
right.
what he's doing
so if
is
you find out later that you actually were misinformed.
Sure,
you were still wrong.
Well, you were wrong for violating your conscience. Now
right.
it turns out if you find out you're misinformed, then you can do what is appropriate, and your conscience shouldn't have any qualms about it because now you're more educated about the morality of the action itself. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But so I do think this can have application to our current circumstances. If a person genuinely thinks, as I talked with another caller about, that if you take the vaccine, which vaccine had come from, at least it's somewhere down the line, developed as a result of experimentation with aborted fetuses, mm-hmm. And in your mind, that's wrong, even if it's not wrong. And that's the case I make. I don't think it is wrong in itself. If you think it's wrong, then don't do it. That's what mm-hmm. Paul is saying here in Romans 14. Just don't do it. And so that would be a legitimate reason for you to contend against the government. Now, what happens if the government does not give the exemption and still demands under force of law that you do this thing? Well, then you have to ask yourself the question whether or not this is the hill you're going to die on, and whether the harm that's caused by the prosecution, unjust prosecution, is a greater harm than just doing the thing that you think is wrong. And a lot of times under that kind of threat, people give in because it's just not worth it. And there's not that much at stake ultimately, but that's an individual decision.
Right.
Make sense?
Yeah. Well,
okay.
But wouldn't I be, if I decided it wasn't worth it and I went along with it, wouldn't that be a sin then if I genuinely felt?
Well, in that situation, I think that you're facing a moral dilemma. Okay. And so, look at, if I put a gun to your head and said, I'm going to kill you unless you help me rob this store, even standard jurisprudence does not hold you responsible for that which you were forced to do.
Mm-hmm.
What it says is, one thing you can't do is you can't kill somebody to save your own life, but you can steal something to save your own life. So there is a principle there where it seems morally acceptable to do a wrong to prevent a greater harm. And I think that's a biblical concept as well. It's a graduated morality, and you have to assess both sides of the issue. So if somebody says, okay, you don't believe you should have your hair cut, and if you don't have your hair cut, we're going to put you in prison. Well, I'd get my hair cut. They're forcing me with the threat of serious repercussions if I don't do this thing. I'm not morally responsible for cutting my hair. Even if it was immoral, right. You know.
Well, but what if you are convinced, though, that the haircut is just the beginning? And after that, they're going to say, well, now you have to, I don't know, paint your face.
Sure. Well, this is kind of I got it. This is a kind of a slippery slope kind of argument, and one has to look at the details. It may be just the beginning, and so that is a concern. But it doesn't mean that if it's just the beginning that you can, okay, I'm just not going to do it and I'm going to go to prison. If the thing that they're asking you to do is just the first step to more things, then we take note of that process and we try to point that out. But it doesn't mean we can't do the first thing. I'm concerned about the vaccine thing, partly for that reason. What's next? But I'm not responsible for what next if I decide for my own reasons to get the vaccine.
Well, but isn't the fact that people are going along with it going to ultimately be the reason why they get to continue escalating it?
Wait, say that again. I'm sorry.
Isn't the fact that a large portion of the population is going along with mandates going to be really the reason why they are allowed to? Because the only reason they're able to keep escalating it is because people are going along with it. Really.
Yes, I agree with that. And so this is where you have a judgment call that has to be made. And I do agree that at some point we got to start saying no. And I'm glad a lot of people are saying no to the vaccine. And the more who say no, the more the government is taking note of the fact that people are saying no, because now it's hurting the government in some ways and businesses, et cetera. But each individual person is going to make his own decision about that, where that line is. I got to run, Josh, and I thank you for your call. I want to catch Michelle. And Michelle, my apologies for giving you like 3.5 minutes.
But once,
give me a shot here, and let's see if I can get a quick response for you.
Yeah, I have a Christian friend, evangelical, who argues that we shouldn't illegalize abortion. We should just add more social programs because they do more to reduce abortion. I know that's not a true argument. I know that's more of like a line from the kind of abortion industry.
Yeah.
But I established life beginning at conception with her. She didn't argue with me substantially on that. I compared abortion to like slavery. Should we have put in social programs for former slaves before we illegalized it? You know, she couldn't really argue with that, and so on.
Okay.
But she still holds her position.
Okay.
So I'm
all right.
Kind
so
of at a loss.
What you're doing is really good. Sorry for jumping in. Just moving quickly here, that you're giving counterexamples of her view to show that, wait a minute, this this isn't going to work the way you want. So if you said something, here's another counterexample, it's what I thought of right away. If you said something like, well, children are being abused and molested, but instead of making that illegal, we'll just add more social programs. Now, it might be that social programs are good for that, but it's not an either or. It's a both and, given the gravity of the offense. Maybe social programs might help, but I'll tell you one thing that will help. You make child abuse illegal, period. That will stop it. It will, you know, that's much more effective. And obviously so. Obviously so. You know how many abortions we have every single day? The same amount of people that died in 9/11, 2,977 in 9/11. That happens every working day in America for the last 48 years. Okay, so social programs? Would we say, okay, well, some social programs, so 3,000 people a day don't die? No, why don't we just say, let's stop killing them? That's the best way to stop it. Now, we might encourage more people to cooperate or whatever by having social programs. Nothing wrong with that. But it is very, I'm not even sure how to characterize this, but it's not even short-sighted. It's not even myopic. It's like borderline, pardon the word, dumb. It's borderline dumb. We should not outlaw abusing children. We should just have more social programs because that will do it better. Really? Doesn't outlawing just stop it almost immediately? If you want social programs to have less abortions, that means you think abortions are wrong. If they're wrong because they harm innocent human beings, then isn't the fastest way to resolve that the best way? Like saying it's illegal? We don't let it happen? This, you can see, Michelle, this makes no sense to me the way your friend is arguing.
And it doesn't make any sense to me either.
Well, keep offering the counterexamples there and even the one I just offered you, because I think you're on the right track. And if she's not going to play ball with you, well, that's her fault, not yours. All right. Thank you so much for the call, Michelle, in Colorado. All right, friends, that's it for this show. And boy, this one went fast, too. It's great talking to you. Be sure and call during showtime, 855-243-9975. Love to take your calls on any show between 4 and 6 Pacific time. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.